Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the System Reset Series. This is our first in a series of programs about how do you get your business back after unexpected occurrences. And we have two experts on that. They are the authors of a brand new book that I love. Let me tell you the title right now. Everybody make a note, make sure you get it. It's called From GED to Harvard, then Inc. 500. It is a fascinating story. It's entertaining, it's educational, and it's inspirational. And we've got the authors on the line. Welcome, Jane and Scott Wolf.
Good morning.
Hey, Ken, good morning. Thank you for having us.
Yes, we appreciate
I'm so pleased. Well, we appreciate you. You know, I know that when you wrote this book, you weren't anticipating a global shutdown.
Nope, this was never on the radar, let me tell you.
Right? I mean, who knew? As my longtime listeners know, I'm very partial to New Orleans. I used to go every winter after the flood from 2006 to 2010, and I met a lot of great people and saw a lot of comeback stories, literally thousands of them. And the people of New Orleans are the world's leading authorities on how to come back from a disaster. And we're going to talk about your whole story, not just the comeback part, but if you don't mind, we're going to focus a little bit on the comeback, because I think it would provide a lot of insight and inspiration to people.
Mm-hmm.
But first, you guys are from a town, I always get confused in New Orleans. Is it east? Is it west? Is it south? Is it north? What town are you guys from?
We're actually born from a suburb of New Orleans, which is to the east of New Orleans, but we always tell everybody New Orleans for reference. All about business opportunities and businesses have always been in the heart of New Orleans. They do have a section called, you know, New Orleans wraps around the Mississippi River. So you've got uptown, Bywater, New Orleans East, you know, towns within New Orleans. But primarily, we've always been in the heart of New Orleans.
But we grew up in Chalmette. I came out my mother's womb at Hotel Du Hospital. My parents lived in New Orleans in the very beginning of our lives. And then they went to Chalmette.
Gotcha.
So that's where we grew up, in Chalmette.
Gotcha. I wanted you to mention that because it's a very beautiful place and is the home of many beautiful people.
Yes, it's right next to the Ninth Ward.
Yep. Well, great. So now let's talk about how you started your business career. Jane, you got yourself pregnant. At 17?
I don't know if I got myself pregnant. I mean, who made Coon pregnant, right?
You had a little help there. You had a little help.
Yeah.
This is not generally a recipe for success. First of all, that must have been a shock.
Well, you know, when you're young, you don't realize what's going on around you or what's going on in you. So I was very lucky to come from a family that had business in their blood, so to speak. So when you say how I came into business, but I got pregnant first, yes, I did get pregnant first, and I thank God today that I got pregnant by the man that I got pregnant by. So it's not a recipe for success, but I can say that when I did become pregnant as a teenager at 15 years old, I never looked back and I only looked at what I had to do. And that's it. I didn't think of the future and I didn't think of the past. So that's sometimes a recipe for success, just thinking about that in the sense that you just think about what you need to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we just needed to, Scott, get married and...
Yeah, well, young people, teenagers don't realize what's ahead of them. So we didn't know it was as scary of a forecast as what our parents or others realized. Like if we saw a couple of teenage kids, 15 and 17 years old today, we would say, oh, my God, they don't know what they got ahead of them. But when you're that age, you don't realize probably a good thing. We were in love and we felt the opportunity and we looked forward to it at the time. And we were always focused on, what type of career we were going to go into. Jane and I both came from entrepreneurial families, so we wanted to go in that direction. So we didn't see the financial hardships.
Yeah, we didn't see no negatives. with being pregnant. I didn't see no negatives in being pregnant.
Interesting, interesting. And you had, and you mentioned you had supportive families that supported you emotionally and also gave you good guidance on the entrepreneurial
yes.
road.
Yes, mostly emotionally, because our parents weren't, I mean, nobody handed us any money. We never, like Scott didn't get a dowry when he, you know, when he married. Of course, we lived at my grandmother's house on Charter Street in the Ninth Ward, it was on Charter Street, right around St. Marie's School in the Ninth Ward, and she let us live on top of the house. She had a little apartment, and we paid $35 a month.
Hmm.
So that's how we started off, you know?
But you did get that training in entrepreneurship, though, by osmosis. You got to see it in action, right?
Yeah. We saw discipline. We saw...
Right. We saw service. We saw discipline. We saw opportunities. We were middle-class families. I get probably lower middle-class, but middle-class families.
I think people who've never been to New Orleans don't realize what an entrepreneurial town it is and how many of the businesses in New Orleans are small businesses and run by families.
Right.
It's not a big chain. I mean, maybe it's changing now, but it's not a. It's traditionally not a big chain, big business, big corporation city. It's a place of,
right.
of shopkeepers and restaurant owners and service
That's
people.
Right.
So what families were your business? Yeah, go ahead.
Inclusive of the neighborhoods. The neighborhoods were all, especially before Katrina, were all typical corner groceries, corner hardware stores, corner barbershops, barrooms, drug stores, were all these little neighborhoods that had their own corner stores. Katrina got rid of 60% of that. 60% of that did not come back. Neighborhoods
60%.
Came back, but the corner stores did not. Correct.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, let's talk about your first business, which you set up in statistically one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in America.
Yeah, it really wasn't, you know. And looking back on it, Ken, I can honestly say we didn't realize at the time. It was only in the last 5 to 7 years, have we really started reflecting on the neighborhoods that we were operating in as dangerous. We
mm-hmm.
never did feel danger. I don't know if it was our youth or just optimistic thinking, but I don't ever remember thinking we were in dangerous areas, but the statistics showed us we were.
Yeah. It's like all major metropolitan cities, you know, you turn the news on at night, you see all the shootings, you see all the crime, but during the day when you're doing business transactions and you're meeting people who are family oriented,
right.
you typically don't see it. So we didn't realize, just like the people who lived in those neighborhoods, the good families that lived there, they didn't realize how bad it is. But statistically, when you put it on paper and compare it to suburbs or different cities, you see like, well, this is the highest crime rate. This is the highest unemployment rate. This is the highest welfare rate. This is the lowest education rate. And then that's when you start to say, you know, wow, how did we pick these locations and then drop them?
But on Desire and Galvez, we didn't feel that. We felt neighborhood and good people coming into the grocery store. I mean, I don't know if the grocery store was like safe haven, but it felt safe haven. We never did feel scared on Desire and Galvez.
Well, I think people don't realize that so-called bad neighborhoods are filled with good people.
Right.
You know, just because the numbers are bad and there are a few bad characters floating around doesn't mean that the whole neighborhood is bad. And, of course, for you as young people with very limited means, that was where your opportunity was. You couldn't open a big flagship store on Canal Street.
No, surely.
That's right.
No, we couldn't.
We couldn't afford the rent. We couldn't afford the purchase price. It's littered with competition. So, you know, we had to find the rubies on the coal. So we would go when the businesses were running out of the inner city markets, we were
running in.
Yeah, running into them.
We realize that now as we look back, that was happening.
I mean, it's such a great service because one of the many challenges that people with low incomes living in low income neighborhoods is they call them food deserts. It's hard to even get food of any kind, let alone good food. So speaking of good food, let's talk about your first business and how you found it and how you built it up and transformed it into something big.
But Scott, Desire and Galvez. No, Desire and Galvez.
Yeah. Our first store was a bankrupt store. It was the only thing we could afford. It cost us $20,000. We only had $10,000 saved, so we actually had to take a partner in for the additional $10,000. and it was only doing about $200 a day, not nearly enough to pay even bankrupt bills. But that was the only type of that. But we saw the opportunity there. There was a butcher there named Tom who had been with that location. It was named Wagner's. Our last name is Wolf, so we inherited the name Wagner's and since have named it Wagner Meat. Tom was the butcher that had worked for the Wagner family since he was 12 years old, and at the time he was probably about 40. It was the only job he ever had. He couldn't read or write, but that's, he was a butcher, the authentic old-style butcher. And Tom took me aside when I looked at the facility and told me how great the location was and how great it used to be and that the current owner mismanaged it. So it's a little bit on his faith and a little bit on our intuition. Being in the area working for Jane's father, we felt like it was a good location. So we found a partner and opened the doors.
Which my father's grocery was, his little grocery was about, what, eight blocks, maybe a mile away.
Yeah.
A mile away.
Okay.
So we knew the neighborhood.
And we quickly turned that location around, bought out the partner, and then that particular location, as Tom promised, it grew and grew to the point where we had to do something with the cash flow we were making, which caused us to look at new opportunities around the town. So we started buying up corner grocery stores in different pockets of the city. And then we got to about five, and then we found a piece of property that was vacant. And that's that was our first venture into developing.
Out the neighborhood on a highway.
But
basically what we did, Ken, at that grocery store on Desire and Galveo's, we cleaned it up, and we offered the best service, personal service that we could humanly muster, and we took great pride in our produce being impeccable, our meat case being perfect, and our employees being happy to be working with us, and we just provided a need, and we gave it the best that we could do, and the neighborhood totally embraced it, and we went from $200 a day to like $5,000 a day within probably a year.
At that one location?
At that one location. Yeah.
Incredible.
That was back in 1980. It was unbelievable.
Wow. You must have been like water in the desert for that neighborhood to have such a good store.
And that's what it was, because there was no food stores around the big grocery stores, A&P or Winn-Dixie or whatever. They were leaving the area. And actually, like you said, we were providing food to a food desert. And the academic term of food desert didn't come to like 25 years later. But that's why we were so successful, because there was such a need.
Tell me a little bit about your employees. You mentioned that the key man, the butcher, but of course it probably takes a lot of people, a lot of hands to run a shop like that. How did you find people? How did you bring them in? How did you create the atmosphere that you did at that early store?
It was basically just a neighborhood.
Yeah.
We just hired from the neighborhood.
Yeah, but just like it's a food desert, it's also an employment desert. So it's not hard to find employees within, 1 mile, 2 mile radius that want to work for you. And then quite often throughout the career, we've had 300 employees for 35 years with operations that ran 24 hours, 7 days a week. And the overwhelming majority of these employees were family.
Right. Everybody recommend their cousin or their friend or their.
We had lots of large families working for us around each location.
Yeah.
Incredible. So you built
employees
the business up. Pardon me?
Employees were never hard to find.
Plus,
they were never hard to find.
Never.
And I think we provided a sanctuary. I think our facilities, which we try to provide today, even with Melba's, is we try to make the place as enjoyable of a place to work at, that it actually creates a sanctuary where people...
A lot of happenings that were at home.
Yeah. They got inside the neighborhood. They got financial problems, they got stress problems, they got family problems that we all have, but it seems magnified in the city areas to where the business is actually
a sanctuary.
Wow.
But we didn't realize that until we're looking back, right, and writing our book. We didn't realize that's what we were building other than just building up sales up.
And also when you're in the middle of all this, Ken, as you're growing and you're operating business, you don't realize how much you are affecting your employees. You're constantly concentrating just on customers, how to satisfy customers, how to get more customers. You don't realize the impact that you are having on your employees until years, decades later, and they come back and tell you. the effect that you get on them. You know, why they're succeeding at this, or what they learned was to you, and how much they enjoy working for you, and why. And we've gotten countless cards and comments from people who have worked with us over the years. When you employ 300 people for 30 years, that extrapolates out to, you know, tens of thousands of people
sure.
they turn over. So,
sure.
But we're also not going to say, we can't sit here and say we never had any issues at Desire and Galvez, right?
I'm sure. You must have, right?
Yeah, I mean, although we were never robbed, in which we take, there's beauty in that. I mean, you know,
we've had everything else.
Well, one of your secret weapons, and I want to bring this up early in the call so I make sure I get it through, and it comes through in the book, and it's a simple thing, but good manners. You know, good manners to your employees creates an atmosphere, and I think that might have been one of your secret weapons. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, people may not be aware of the beautiful manners that people have in New Orleans. It's quite unique in America, I think. Maybe you don't see it because you're from there, but people that have themselves together, the average person, has a higher level of manners, I think. And I don't mean manners like formality or, you know, fake manners. I just mean, I don't know, politeness, consideration, patience, kindness, humanity, those kinds of qualities. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think it is true that, again, maybe Southern hospitality or particularly New Orleans. I can tell you that as we travel and we come to New Orleans, we always, even ourselves being natives, we find it where, you know, people will talk to you more openly and spontaneously here, maybe more than other places. I can tell you, just the other day, we went to the French Quarter to check it out and to see how vacant it is. And the neighbors in the French Quarter, all sitting, the ones that live there as residents in the French Quarter, they're all sitting on their porch. They got chairs out, and they invite you over. You just walk by, and they try to stop you to talk to you. So I think you're correct about that. I just think it's maybe, I don't know if it's a port city or it's just a New Orleans thing, but I don't want to say that we do it and nobody else does it.
Right, and also in the book, what I tried to show with talking about manners is that, you know, sometimes you have this thought that a boss or a business owner, when you do something wrong, they're going to stress you down and chastise you. We never did have action of that sort in our grocery stores. Like when an employee did something wrong or gave too much meat away or didn't wrap it right, or we taught. We showed. We said, look, you can't do it like this. You have to do it like this. But it wasn't in a dressed-down format to make anybody feel bad. Like, so that's what I mostly tried to get across with the manners aspect. You just got to be the businessman has to see himself as a teacher or the business owner or the business person. They teach in so much. I remember just taking, for instance, and now this has had to do with my son, I remember I had him wrap lettuce at the store when he was young.
Okay.
And I can honestly say I was harder on my son than I was on the employees, because he was wrapping lettuce one day and he wasn't wrapping it right. I mean, he was flipping the plastic over it and he wasn't sealing it right. And I remember, and he remembers this too, I made him redo the whole case of lettuce. He wrapped 48 lettuce. And I said, how can you wrap lettuce like this? It's only going to last a day. Right? So he had to redo the whole case. So what I'm saying is that's how we would teach people. We wouldn't cast on. We'd just say you have to do the whole thing over. And
nice. Yeah. And I think Scott's point is not that New Orleans has a monopoly on manners, but it does set it does set a pace. Just like
that's
music,
right.
For example. Like music. There's music everywhere, but there aren't many towns as musical as New Orleans, you know?
That's right.
Let's fast forward now to that fateful day when the storm came and went, but the levees failed and everybody was up to their necks in water. Let's talk about you cover that in the book, and I just want to say real fast for people that aren't unaware, it wasn't just a flood of a day. There were many neighborhoods that had water, high water in them for weeks. So it wasn't the water came and went, and that water sitting there for weeks is very damaging.
Well, one thing I wanted to say, I could say about that initially, I remember when Scott came home one day and told me, he says, you know, we could have took a fire at every location. He said that would have been all right. This was, you know, he says, but it's not only the location that's down, it's the whole neighborhood down, right?
Right.
So all our groceries had, the neighborhoods were down too. So I remember him telling me that, and I realized there's certain types of disaster that's worse than others.
Mm-hmm.
And Katrina was bad in that respect, that the neighbors were affected also, not just the business owner, which can also talk about today, right? The business owner just isn't affected, but the people that frequent your business are affected too. And that is a special type of business interruption.
Not only your neighborhood, but you mentioned your customers. It's interesting.
Right.
You talk about them as your neighborhood. You didn't even use the word customers. I think in your mind, it's one thing, which might be the right view. But not just customers, but they were gone. Your employees were scattered. Your vendors were disrupted. Utilities were down. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to make that point when this thing first hit in March. I said to everybody, okay, this is bad, but it's not New Orleans. New Orleans lost everything. So everybody knows, has a sense of what the disaster was. Let's talk about the comeback. How on earth, you had a whole bunch of stores, they were all wiped out. Your customer base was wiped out. Your vendor supply chain was wiped out. The simple electricity and water wasn't working to a lot of places.
Yeah.
I mean, you name it. Traffic lights didn't work. I mean, nothing worked.
Right.
There were piles of garbage everywhere. There were nails in the streets. You couldn't drive five blocks without getting a puncture in your tire. I mean, that went on for months. So, but you came back. So what did you do? How did you do it?
The first thing we had to do is we had to pay the electric guy in a utility truck driving by. I had to pull him over and pay him $100 to turn a switch on up at the telephone pole, even though we were ready to get electricity, and they couldn't even tell us when they would come by and turn it on. But you're correct. There were zero customers, zero neighborhoods. So it's a chicken or the egg. You know, do you spend $1 million to renovate this facility with zero neighborhood?
Mm.
Who's going to go first? Did it wait for the customers to come back? So
the first thing you did was clean up.
Yeah, that's the first
thing. That's the first thing.
And we were quarantined out of New Orleans. Remember, it's August 29th, the storm hit, 2005, and they didn't let anybody back into New Orleans until late September, October. So... You had to live in another city, which is one reason why, 150,000 people never came back. They created roots and got jobs in other cities, schools in other cities.
But we talk about it in a book about what we kind of did. While Scott was cleaning up the groceries with bulldozers going into the buildings, we popped out the front of the buildings and had bulldozers just
push
it all out. It's almost like we had blank slate. We were seeing that construction was needed, and then we fell into the roofing business while we are cleaning up the groceries.
Wow. So this is amazing. So all those years you had been a grocery business, and that has a very specific set of requirements and mindset and all that, and all that got wiped out, and you went into the you just did what had to be done, which was go into the construction business.
Right, and one thing that I look back, everybody needed a roof, right? So unconsciously we knew we weren't going to have customers until they had roofs. And I think that's how we fell into the roofing business, because it was such a need that unconsciously we knew they needed roofs. People needed roofs before they can come back home. So we can't have customers at the groceries so they can live in their house.
Let me give you a little baseline background story here. My father was a contractor all his life. I grew up in a construction home, so I kind of grew up with construction knowledge, working at his job sites. And Jane kind of grew up more in the grocery business than I did. And my dad had the grocery store. My dad had a construction company. That's why we said we both came from entrepreneurial backgrounds. And I had gotten my construction license in 1999, way in advance of 2005 Katrina. And we were developing commercial property for our own investments. So when the storm hit and all of our properties, our Wagner Meats were out of business, our 10 locations, no employees, no customers, no neighborhoods. And then it would have cost millions of dollars. We had insurance, but insurance was just a piece of paper that you had to negotiate years later to settle all kind of losses. It wasn't that you get a check for all of this. So you had to have the capital to put all this back into business. And even if you did, why would you do it? Because there's no neighborhood. But we did see, and so we said, okay, we have a contractor's license, and we are, you know, this is obviously a honey hole for construction now. So we're going to invent this construction company. We took one of our locations and made it a yard, a corporate office for the construction company, and the flagship right at the most one of the busiest intersections of New Orleans. So we became sizable very quickly because we were, a local company. We took a lot of our employees from the Wagners, the core team, and we turned them into construction people, selling jobs, running equipment, running materials. And that's what resurrected our ability to financially survive, their ability to financially survive, the families and the relatives and the employees. And then we also very systematically throughout the year or years put together the abandoned properties as the neighborhoods came back.
Yes, we needed cash. And insurance companies were paying, we realized insurance companies were paying Ruth very quickly. And that's how we pivoted. We saw the cash, the ability to get cash.
Gotcha.
And cash to pay everybody in the construction business, right? So we were an employer quickly during the Katrina times, other than groceries.
Yeah, from 2006, January 2006 to 2012,
we focused on construction.
We did a lot of construction. We did 400 projects, about $40 million of business. And then that put us, like I said, back into the commercial real estate business. And then that's exactly how Melba's was born, out of the Wolfman construction era, because Melba's was a commercial development. And the intention of Melba's was a commercial development to lease out, and we could not find a tenant to rent it. And that's how that concept was born.
Gotcha. And let's talk about Melba's in one second, but I just want to highlight something.
Sure.
You turned, just as you were geared for a grocery business, all your employees were geared for grocery business. They weren't construction guys. They weren't construction industry people. And somehow you were able to convert your labor force, your workers, your employees, into a totally different mindset, a totally different job. How did that?
Yeah. Well, we had some core people that were in the grocery business, like this guy Leonard and Bucket. His name was Bucket. He's in our book, actually, and he's at Melba's too. They were not converted, but they would just knock at our door and say, Scott and Jane, what you got? What you doing? What you got?
Well,
you know what I mean?
We're not the only ones in the midst of these strange biblical times. They too are in these situations.
Sure.
They hustle too.
Yeah,
right.
They're willing to learn. They're willing to work. They pivot. They survive. They're survivors.
Right.
And they believe us too. They believe in our ability to
lead out the sleeve.
Yeah. Lead it. Invest in it. Promote it. And they've seen it. They've seen us do it through a few businesses now, and they're comfortable with the understand this.
And also, Ken, I think anybody can pivot if you help.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can pivot. You just need help. You need an outstretched arm. You need, come on, let's do it. You know what I mean?
Well, everybody listening to this call, they're pivoting. They're in trouble. They're pivoting themselves. We're all changing, adapting through this.
You have ways to pivot if somebody is along your side. And we've always had people along our side. We've always been along other people's side, and we somehow get through the storm.
Mm.
You just got to keep rowing, and you got to keep walking. You can't curl up in a fetal position inside your house.
Yeah, amen, amen. And just as a side note, going back again to the neighborhoods that you worked in, you know, people look at these neighborhoods and think there is no talent, there is no hardworking people, there is no heart, and then that's not true at all. What there may be is a lack of leadership, and you provided the leadership. And once you did it, all those human talents came to the fore. Now, let's talk about Melba. So I love, like so many of your projects, you didn't necessarily plan it out. It turned into something different than what you originally intended. So, Scott, you were saying that it was originally just a commercial real estate project for you.
Yeah, it was just a two-suite rental that we were renting out, vanilla shell and for lease. And Jane was embarking at the time. When we started construction, Jane actually went back to college. She not went back to college. She went to college for the first time. She went to Tulane University and graduated from Tulane. And then she went to Harvard in 2012 to 2015. So while she was doing all that, we were developing Wolfman, and also we stumbled into Melba's. And Jane... It was Jane's idea to put the po' boy shop there. And I pulled my
bike. Well, I don't know if it was my idea to put the pole boy shop there. One day I came home from school, or I came in town, and he passed the location, and he says, "I bought this." And I'm like, "You bought this?" I said, I mean, you bought this? He said, "Yeah." He says, "I think this will go. So he had my blessing in a sense. I had to get back to study, right? And I'm like, yeah, a pole boy shop will work good there. There's no doubt. We have a lot of rooftops around us. We have 25,000 cars that pass. You almost can never make a wrong decision when you have 25,000 cars that pass in front of you. And it had an energy that just needed something at this location he had.
Yeah, it's we know that New Orleans is a very small town. You can get from one side of New Orleans to the other within 15, 20 minutes. So you can pass through New Orleans in 20 minutes. So we know every pocket of New Orleans and every corner, major corner, and we've operated on a lot of them. We have property across the street from Melba's that we've had since Katrina. So we know this corner as well. That's why it felt like it was a great location. Po' Boy Shop is, we've had Po' Boy Shops inside of Wagner's for 30 years. So the food that's inside Melba's is no different than food that we've had at Wagner's. The only thing different is this is not a gas station with gas pumps or a grocery store or a meat market. Mm. Mm-hmm. But it does, you know, the Wagner's that we developed over the years were multi-suite retail centers as well, with laundromats and check cash and gas stations and convenience stores.
Oh.
Melba's very similar to Wagner's. Plus, when we opened up the doors at Wagner's, the neighborhoods and the city quickly realized that although it was named Melba's, these were the Wagner meat people. A lot of the people that are still with us at Melba's have been with us for 30 years. Even though Melba's is only 7.5 years old, we still have brought some of the talent from Wagner's into Melba's. So the word of mouth spread very quickly that, the Wagner meat people own Melba's. That's right. The food is, it's a typical New Orleans type of homemade cooked plate food, baked macaronis, gumbo, et cetera, as well as pool boys. So it's really 35 years of compressed experience jammed into the 7.5 years of Melba's.
Gotcha. And I want to talk a little bit about how you integrated so many different kinds of services into single stores. That may be an unusual thing for people. They may have never seen anything like that. It's a little more common in New Orleans, but I think you took it even to a new level. Talk about the thinking behind adding all these different services under one roof.
Well, I think one aspect of our thinking comes from our days in the grocery business, right? So we had groceries where when we were in a grocery business, we were given a neighborhood everything it needed from one location, right? So we even had video rentals at the grocery. Mm. We cashed checks. We sold money orders. One time we tried to start up a pharmacy inside the grocery store. We had delis. What else we did? We developed film. We did so many things inside the grocery store that I think it's just the way we think. And we always think that a business should have...
Diversity.
Yes.
And paranoia.
Right. And business should never just have one line of income. If you can have a business that has many different lines of income, that's beneficial to you when one line goes down.
Yeah.
So the thing that we hooked it to, which was great, was the laundromat. Right? So not only do people come to Melba's to get a po' boy, but you can also do your clothes. And when you're doing your clothes for an hour or two, what more can you do than eat? Right? So eat and drink with the daiquiris, and that's what people are doing.
There you go. Now, believe it or not, Jane and Scott, there are people that don't know what a po' boy is.
Right.
And so maybe you could explain this wonderful culinary invention of New Orleans.
Sure. It's very similar. To relate to them, it's very similar to a Subway shop or Jersey Mike's or Jimmy John.
We have beautiful French bread.
It's a French bread from France that was invented here in New Orleans or brought here to New Orleans, and it's called the French bread. Instead of calling it the French bread sandwich, they call it a po' boy sandwich. And the history of the po' boy, it's really poor boy, P-O-O-R. And it goes back 100-plus years when the streetcars drivers were striking, and the Martin Brothers sandwich shop made a gravy sandwich and for 5 cents, and he said, here comes another poor boy
that we're going to help out.
Right, and that redefined the name of that sandwich. And ever since then, it's been called Po' Boy or Poor Boy sandwiches, which is a special French bread instead of a soft Subway type of bread. It's basically the
but also amazing. Like, for instance, you talk about your shrimp strategy. Can you talk about how you assemble your shrimp po' boy?
You know, in business, Ken, you always got to give people more than they expect. And we knew that in New Orleans, you know, people advertise their shrimp po' boys all the time. And we always know in New Orleans that you get a lot of food, right? People can always, when they come down here, they say they get a lot of food. But what's so beautiful about our po' boy is that we said, you're going to get 30 shrimp on this sandwich. And there was something marketable about that that stuck in people's heads. And they're like, wow, I'm going to get 30 shrimp. So we put a mathematical formula on the shrimp po' boy, and it became our bestseller.
How do you like that? Incredible.
Yeah. So
incredible.
So we count out 30 shrimp on every po' boy.
It's got a guarantee.
And it's got a guarantee. If you only got 29 shrimp, we'll give you all the shrimp.
Right,
so we take people at, you know, some people come up as fun, and they say, oh, I'm short of shrimp. All right, here's another shrimp. You know? So it's kind of funny, but it works. Whenever you put fun into a transaction, you know, it's more deep-seated in the heart. So when you walk
Absolutely.
In Melvis, I don't know if you've ever walked in Melvis, but it's Not fun
yet.
When you walk in. Somebody, you know, when people come in, they're just amazed at how many things are binging. I mean, for instance, when our ovens are ready for stuff to come out of it, we have all different sounds, like a chicken or a moo cow. Or it's not just ding, 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 the oven's ready to be open. It's a sound. So it's kind of an experience just to go to Melvis.
Gotcha. Speaking of heartful interactions, you started something at the original stores at the Wagners where if a child had a good report card and they brought it in, you'd give them ice cream or something? Or I forget how that worked.
Yeah, simple ice cream. And we talk about that in the book because that was one of our first wrestles Scott and I had, right? I mean, I wanted to give away free ice cream for A's on report cards because I knew how my kids felt when they got an A, right? Because whenever my kids came home with an A, I was able to give them something. You know, I gave them, I don't know, $5 or whatever it was. So, I don't know, just one day I just decided to, kids in the neighborhood should get something for an A on their report card. And we had this ice cream, and it worked like a charm. I mean, kids used to come in, and they still come in Melba's because we do it a little differently, but just to see that smile on their face for soft serve ice cream, and the mom was happy too. You know, she was able to give them something.
Yeah. And
it worked like a storm, and that's when I started realizing, I realize it more today, but that was corporate social responsibility, right? That's engaging with the community. I never realized I was engaging in an academic term, but
sure.
Just engaged in that way. And I think it also created good vibes in the community for us doing so. In fact, I know it did.
And this translated into Melba's being the fastest growing company in Louisiana by Inc. Magazine.
Right.
So how do you like that? Hey, speaking of academic terms, you know, we started this call mentioning that you became pregnant at 15. I imagine there was no high school, but
right.
Eventually you got your GED, but somehow you
right.
ended up at Harvard. What were you studying in Harvard? What was your degree? What did you learn?
Well, what I did was, what I learned that, wow, there's so much to learn, right?
I know. It's not a short answer.
Education. I guess one thing I learned at Harvard is, one of the most profound things I learned at Harvard is that life experiences matter. And sometimes you can have, there's so much learning that goes in to what you're doing at life. And I realized what I learned at Harvard is, especially at Divinity School, I learned that we have a responsibility to share the knowledge that we have. I guess just going to Harvard and going to higher education made me realize that we have a lot of knowledge from our life experiences and we have to do something with it. And, you know, making money is easy, but we got to do something with the knowledge that we have. And I think that's what a higher education did for me mostly. It made me realize we have to do more than just raise sales and make money and, I don't know. It just made me look at it And it also made me see the business owner as a teacher more than anything.
We talked about that earlier in the call, yeah.
Yeah. So it just reaffirmed that the business person can see himself as a teacher. And I think that's where the community engagement comes in with the business owner, to let him see that if he engages with the community, he can have lasting impact.
Jane mentioned that there's a lot of bling going on, a lot of bling going on at Melba's. And she's right that, you know, as she's taking this journey through education and we've tried to take and turn the lens on our employees and customers more than us. If you go to Melba's today, all of our employees are highlighted on our counters. So we've got photographs of all the employees, and we got, you know, if they're a mother or father, how many kids they have, what their hobbies are, and then, of course, their favorite food at Melba's. They all have business cards up on a business card rack where they all, you know, they tell customers, just take my business card. We have screens all throughout the building where customers take Instagram photos and hashtags, and they put themselves up on our screens throughout our stores inside and outside.
Oh.
Our laundromat is all local artists, musicians, and, you know, famous people from New Orleans that are highlighted on our washers and dryers with QR codes where they come to life and give you a little history of themselves. So, there's a lot of entertainment going on that we've done with this business that we haven't done with the other business.
Gotcha. Now, there's something else that you did, and this was, I believe, inspired by Jane's sojourn to Harvard. You're working with your employees in a different way in Melba's. You have a different arrangement with them than you've had in your other businesses. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, we started, when I got into the corporate social responsibility aspects of how a business can help the community, I started seeing how just interacting with your leadership at your company can be different too. Instead of all the decisions coming from Scott per se, or this type of leadership that, you know, let's just do what the boss says, I started seeing everybody as able to take this on themselves, right? And I don't know if it's from my 40 years of being in business, when I realize that now that I realize that people just need an outstretched arm more than anything to help them up. But I started seeing Melba's as the petri dish of turning the business over to first-time business owners. Like, you know, people in the leadership position have had it for years, or have been working with us for years. And I just started seeing us as more of coaches and mentors instead of always not telling people what to do, but guiding more of the leaders at the place to be leaders in their community, not just in with community engagement, but leaders for among themselves. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, sure. Bringing the leadership, helping them bring their leadership qualities out in other places.
Yes, and so far as to almost turn it over to them, right, and let them run the show, so to speak. So we're showing the leadership of the employees by showing the pictures of everybody and giving them business cards and saying, you know, they run in this place, but now we're trying to push it where they own this place. And then Scott and I would like to step back and be mentors and coaches to first-time business owners, of which I know can happen at this location.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a work in progress. That's all I can say, but only because of my higher education has Scott had confidence to try to go this route.
Mm-hmm. Because it's different. It's a different approach.
Right. It's a very different approach.
And it's a little more complicated in a way. You have to think more.
Well, you got to think as a coach and not just as a doer.
Yeah. And it's somewhat like a franchise where, you know, you got to have your systems in place and your checks and balances and your mentorship, your meetings. And so you got to teach them not just how to service the customer and, you know, receive orders, but, you know, how to price meals and how to pay bills and how to, you know, market to customers and, you know, the value of a customer, losing a customer. You know, so there's a lot more you got to teach them beyond their regular hourly jobs. So it's a good learning curve for them.
It's a learning curve for both of us, but we both Scott and I have this destination in mind to do, and we feel as though it can happen at this location.
Great. And we're talking with Jane and Scott Wolf. They're the authors of From GED to Harvard, then Inc. 500, How Two Teens Went from CEOs to Building the Fastest Growing Business in New Orleans. And Jane, Scott, I wonder if you have a few minutes when people are talking about a business comeback.
Yeah.
You two are not theorists. It's not a theory for you.
Right.
It's not something you read in a book. Yeah, yeah. But you know what? Maybe this was such a complete presentation that we don't have any questions, which is also fine. But if anybody thinks of one,
sure.
feel free to pipe in. But the book again is called From GED to Harvard, then Inc. 500. It's a charming book. It's fun to read. There's a lot of interesting stories in here that we weren't able to touch on. You know, Scott, for instance, had a very interesting experience with the federal government, which he was able to deal with very skillfully. Good lesson for all of us. I'm talking about that. I don't want to give it. Maybe we'll give this
go
one
ahead,
little
give
story.
It away.
We'll get ready to give away one more story. But really,
yeah,
seriously, guys. Seriously, to everybody, this is a great book, and it's packed with very important lessons, and it's very timely. So I encourage everybody to get it. And you might even want to get multiple copies and give it to people who need a boost, because it's that kind of a book. Yeah, it's funny. Like I said at the beginning, you didn't know we were going to, that the whole world was going to experience something like what you guys experienced, but the whole world is. Yeah, but the whole world is.
Yeah.
And so that makes this book even doubly useful. I mean, this is a good book, even if the sun is shining and everything's fine, because there's a lot of good principles in it on running a business, on customer working, you know, selling, on good relationships with your customers, good relationships with your employees, lifting people up, seeing opportunity. That's all in there too. But then there's also this subcontext, the subplot of what do you do when everything's taken away from you and you have to start from scratch.
Right.
But let's talk about your great operation where you were penalized for being a good guy.
What story is that?
Which one? Oh, yeah, there's so many of them. The beer story.
Oh, the beer. The food stamp. You know, well, let me tell you this about the story. Let me tell you this about the book. I will say this. The book took 2 years to write, 2.5, almost 3 years to write, and we had to put 40 years of stories into 31,000 words. That was so we got a lot more stories than what we have in this book. But this is the one that we thought was good about the food stamps and the beer.
The food stamps, yes. All right, so, you know, Wagner Meat was, meat market was the face of Wagner's, even though we had sold gasoline and check cashing and groceries, the meat market was the face of it.
And we had competition all over.
So we sell what's called meat specials to families, where they come in and buy $50, $100, $200 in meat packages, meat specials, meat deals. And we had other competitors with other corner grocery stores, and they had meat specials as well, and they had meat counters as well. And one way we tried to distinguish ourselves was a competitive advantage, right? We're always looking for a competitive advantage. One thing was, okay, we'll give away beer with a meat special. And that was growing very rapidly for us, and we were becoming known for that. And of course, I guess probably a competitor called the food stamp people and dropped a dom on us. So when it came out and they gave us a citation letter, said we could not do it. And typically, when government tells you can't do it, most people just say, okay, I can't do it. And our personality is we would say, you know, why we can't do it. You know, where's the statute? Where's the law that says I can't do it? I want to read it because I know that there's probably some way around that, even if it says you can't do it. We'll come to find out there is no such law. It's just the law is you can't sell non-food items for food stamps. And this is a non-food item. That was the explanation. And I would explain, but I'm not selling it. I'm giving it away for free.
Right.
You know, yeah, we know it's built into the price, therefore you're selling it. And I'm like, well, if I person buying this meat special with cash, I'm giving it to them too. Nevertheless, they challenged us on it and would not see it our way. And then they started procedures against you, which is what they need to do to take you to what I call their kangaroo court, which is their judge and their jury. And they take you there. And then if you get an adverse verdict, then you can take it from there to a real courtroom, your local jurisdiction, where a judge that's elected by the citizens, and you can bring lawyers in. So we took it up their flagpole to their kangaroo court. And the problem was, when it got to their court, they could see that, you know, I was not going to be intimidated by it. I was not backing down on it. And they just kind of like disappeared on us. They would postpone the hearings. And then finally to the point where they wouldn't send me renewals of when the next hearing was, because it sort of just disappeared off the radar. And we realized, you know, one of the reasons why it disappeared was because they really couldn't figure out a statute to stand on to rule in their favor. Mm-hmm. And then if they did, and we brought it to courtroom, it would be overturned, and then it becomes a new state. It becomes the new law. Like everybody to do it.
And actually, we didn't even realize, because we were young. We just couldn't understand why we couldn't give it free. I mean, it doesn't matter the amount of profit we had inside the meat special or not. It was the free word. And it was like, we can give anything we want for free. So we never realized it was becoming a civil issue with the food stamp. It was deeper than what we thought. You know, it was deeper inside the legalism, which food stamps were for and what they weren't for and who they for. And they just weren't prepared for it.
It opened the floodgates anyway. I mean, once we penetrated past the administrative process of this, and then we just kept selling it, then, of course, the competition jumped on the bandwagon and started doing it as well. And then it's all over the place. And then they got a real problem on their hands, stopping everybody.
But I also think one of your motivations was just to be fair, because your attitude was, well, someone's coming in and buying. Some people are paying cash. Some people are paying with food stamps. We have this free bonus. Why should the food stamp people be penalized?
That's right.
Right? You know, they can't stop me from giving beer, right? You know, so that was a part of the motivation too. Well, this has been such a great call. I think you should have your own podcast. I think every week you should tell stories to get those 40 years of stories recorded. Well, you know, you've got a really unique, unusual experience in business, and there's a lot to learn from it. So the book, again, is From GED to Harvard, Then Inc. 500, Jane and Scott Wolf. I recommend everybody get at least one copy. But also tell people where Melba's is in New Orleans. What's the street address, and what ward is it in, and how do you get there?
We located about 3 minutes away from the French Quarter, and we are located at the crossroads of the 7th, 8th, and Upper 9th Ward. So it's on Elysian Fields, Elysian Fields in Claiborne, and we were open 24 hours a day. Pre-corona. Now we open till midnight, right, Scott?
7 a.m. to midnight.
7 a.m. to midnight. And we never close. The laundromat never closes. The laundromat's open 24 hours a day. But it's 3 minutes from the quarter. So we were getting tourists. But, you know, we deeply rooted in a community, Ken. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the best things that a business owner can do when he opens a business. Get deeply rooted in the community. And when you can do that, you can survive anything.
You know, it's funny, we didn't even mention how you're coping, because, of course, New Orleans is a big tourist town, and all the tourism's
uh-huh.
gone, and I imagine right. Melba's got a lot of tourist dollars.
Right. Well, we did. We only got, I think we only were running about 25 to 30% tourists.
Which is a lot.
But the restaurants inside the quarter, that 70% of their business was for tourism.
Yeah.
They don't want that up there in trouble. We deeply rooted in the community.
Gotcha.
A different way.
Yeah.
So we're going to be okay.
Gotcha.
But we just got to pivot the way we can.
Yeah, we're already 50% back, and we're all still under the stay-home order. We've already had online ordering, telephone ordering, counter service, takeout, outdoor seating. We've already had all that. We're not pivoting at this moment just for those purposes. So we had a good base.
Just
in diversity.
Right. Get deeply rooted in the community, and you'll be well.
Great, great lesson. And that other lesson that you mentioned earlier, too, is diversity. You have a diversity of income sources. So this is helping you. People still have to do their laundry. You know, that's not going to stop.
Right. Think of many ways that your business can provide needs. You don't have to provide just one need. Think of what your business can provide in many ways. I mean, that's why Amazon's popular, right? They can provide you anything at your door.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jane and Scott, thank you so much for sharing your story today, and thank you for this really wonderful, inspiring book. It's a beam of sunshine right now.
I mean it, and the
title again is From GED to Harvard, Then Inc. 500, How Two Teens Went from CEOs to Building the Fastest Growing Business in New Orleans, Jane and Scott Wolf, available from Forbes Books. So thank you all. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. If you're one of the special people that made a big contribution, I'm going to tell you when we can have that private meeting where I'm going to do some consulting with everybody. You'll get that email shortly. So Jane and Scott, thanks again.
Okay, we enjoyed it. All right, Ken. Have a good day.
Take care. Bye-bye. You too.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.